I'm Chris.
And I'm Dev.
And I'm Jim, and this is Topic Lords, the only place on the internet you can hear topics discussed. Chris, would you like to introduce yourself, or do you have anything to plug?
I'm Chris. I go by Charles sometimes. I like to make video games, and I want to plug pickleball because it's really fun, and it's, relative to other racket sports, very easy to get into.
What makes it easy to get into?
The ball likes to travel slowly, and it's like a little bit smaller of a court than tennis, and it's a little bit easier to hit the ball without having it just like fly away.
That's interesting. Like, when I think of a ball that likes to travel slowly, I think of badminton.
Badminton is, the rackets are very small and they're on a stick, so you need a lot of precision. And also the thing travels in such strange shapes, like
that's
in
fair.
Weird, yeah. Trapezoid shapes. Badminton is also very fun, but I think pickleball is easier. It's like big ping pong, so like you don't need the level of precision you need for ping pong.
Yeah.
But you also run a whole lot more.
My wife was suggesting we get into sports, and she was like, do you want to get into pickleball or disc golf?
Oh, nice.
And I was definitely like, I want the one that's like a platformer. I want the one that's like playing Mario.
The one that has levels and terrain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Disc golf is really fun. I don't do it as much as I wish I did. I think I did the Chabot course one time, and it's really cool, which is close to you.
Yeah. And Dev, would you like to introduce yourself, or do you have anything to plug?
Hi, everybody. I'm Dev. I'm an artist. I also like to make video games, and I like to plug mindful breathing. It's something that you can do at any moment, and it's pretty awesome.
Is this like when someone shows you an image that says you are now breathing manually?
Yeah, I guess so. It's awesome that you mentioned that, because I used to do this silly thing. I'd be like, you are now, your next breath will be a conscious breath. It's like, you feel like it's a life hack or something. But it's just so wild how simple practice of taking a breath can be so life-changing.
Tell us more about how this has affected you.
Well, I mean, like, if somebody comes at you, like, either like in work or like outside of work, and they say something unexpected, or you're about to have to say something, like, just the simple act of like stopping and like connecting with your breath and kind of like grounding yourself for a second, just kind of flavors the rest of the experience with a percentage of mindfulness.
Even just taking a deep breath, even not mindfully,
is
good for your mood a lot of the time.
Oxygen, go figure, right?
Yeah. I would like to plug only running one experiment at once.
Elaborate, please.
Yes.
So I recently got diagnosed with ADHD. I started taking Adderall to figure out, like, is this going to help me? Is this good for me? And the first week went great. And the second week, I had like weird, what I thought were maybe Adderall side effects, like brain fog, fever, elevated heart rate, lethargy. They went away after like a couple of days after I had upped my dose to 2 milligrams a day. Mm-hmm. And I figured it was just a transitional thing. And then it happened again when I upped my dose to 3 milligrams. And I was like, this is not working out. So I stopped taking the Adderall and waited a couple of days for the symptoms to recede. And then I was like, well, okay, I should also probably get this like big infection on my leg looked at, which I had known was there for a while, but like my legs are all fucked up anyway. Like I've got psoriasis down there. So like discomfort and even like minor infections are common. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's very easy for me to tune out that stuff. But eventually I was like, you know what, this one's a big boy. So let's go get it checked out. And I was explaining this cloud of everything happening to the doctor. And he was like, you're right that a lot of that stuff is probably the Adderall, but you also definitely have an infection that we need to deal with. And they gave me antibiotic IV, and all the shit that I thought was the Adderall just immediately cleared up. Like,
oh, wow.
Brain fog went away entirely.
That's awesome.
And I was like, first of all, good. I'm not going to die now.
Yes.
Or lose a leg. But also like, this really screws up my experiment with Adderall.
Yeah.
Because I basically need to start over now in order to figure out like what the effects actually were.
You can really mess your data up if you just make sure to overlap starting Adderall before you finish the antibiotics. I don't know if you did already, but
yeah, no, I have not finished them yet, and I intend to wait. Yeah.
Okay. Dang. So yeah, I guess you're really back to square one.
Well, not yet. I look forward to being at square one.
Yeah. That's fair.
Like right now, I would put myself at like 80% capacity. I feel like a little bit like being drunk, and I was going to say unpleasantly drunk, but I think being drunk is just unpleasant to begin with. So like that doesn't help like give you a sense of it.
Sure.
But I feel that same kind of impairment of like slowness, like mental slowness, reflex slowness. So hopefully the remainder of the antibiotic regimen is going to deal with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fingers crossed. Did you like make any other notes about your experience, I guess, either with the Adderall or with the antibiotics?
Like the first week went really well. And I wasn't sure at the time, and still am not, whether like my, I was very mindful and productive that week, and by like able to switch tasks when I decided to, which has been an ongoing problem my whole life. But I don't know if that was just like I had went into that week saying like, okay, as a way to test this medication, I made a point of like, I'm going to be really productive this week. Mm-hmm. And that could have been what caused it, was that decision.
You got to add another row to your spreadsheet.
Yeah, that was, I guess I ruined that. I doubled up on experiments there too.
I guess that one hopefully is easier to A/B test, because like eventually you will be like, it's a week, and like not think about that.
Yes. Yeah. Once I stop paying attention, then I'll get the real data.
Mm-hmm.
Are we ready to start on some topics?
Yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Dev, your topic is taking improv classes has been life-changing.
Oh, it has. It has been so life-changing. I'm so glad to be able to talk about it. If anybody hits me up, I'm always excited to talk about improv. I love it. It's been so great.
Yeah, let's hear
it. How did you even find out that you wanted to do this?
Well, I mean, I was a thespian in high school, and that was interesting and fun. But then, like, you know, the rest of my life flew by until, you know, nowadays. And along the way, you know, you like watch things like Whose Line Is It Anyway to like enjoy that stuff. But without going into another topic, like with D&D, it was through D&D that I was like, wow, so much a part of this experience is improvisation and co-creation with other people. And I really enjoyed that. And so Alex from work, she took improv classes and kind of recommended that I try it. And I dove in. It's like 2024. Let's try something new. And man, I'm so glad I did it. It's been the best thing ever.
So how is it? How has it improved your life?
I've taken mindful breaths earlier. I think beforehand, just in general, I had like a mindfulness practice that eventually no longer worked for me. Whereas improv is kind of like an umbrella that under it contains activities of mindfulness. So you're like, you're being actively aware of the present moment, like what's going on. You're responding to it with acceptance. Like the big golden rule in improv is yes and. And then you're committing to accepting what's happening and adding to it. So you're kind of like playing along with life. It's such a fun way to go about things.
Like there's definitely a big attention aspect to like mindful breathing, like a very immediate and obvious attention aspect. Is that also a big deal in improv?
Attention, like keeping attention?
Yeah, like maybe like paying attention to like how you feel in the moment, or like paying attention to like what the other folks are doing in your scene or whatever, or like how does it kind of work?
Oh yeah, like totally both. Because a lot of the times, like if things are happening very quickly, like a scene's being developed, like on the spot, you don't have time to really get in your head. And it's kind of recommended that you don't. You're just paying attention to where the focus of the scene is. Like, so whoever's talking, you're actively listening to what they're saying. And then all you really need to do is respond to the last thing that they say.
Okay.
And so that's kind of a relief too, because sometimes the focus is jumping around between the room, between different people, and it's a lot to keep up with. So yeah, like that active listening really helps. But then also kind of being mindful or aware of like when in doubt, if you don't know where to come from, you can kind of like just come from an emotional place. Like if a scene's about to start, I'm so excited talking about this stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, if a scene's about to start and like you don't know what character you're going to play, you can just pick an emotion or like how you're feeling inside. Like just spin the big Wheel of Fortune wheel. And like if happy comes up, then like you just start the scene happy and you go from there.
That's really cool. You also had told me previously that you're doing two classes. You're doing an improv class and like an improv class with the D&D tilt. Mm-hmm. And I intentionally didn't ask you too many details about that.
Oh, yeah,
I
wanted that makes
to
sense.
Talk to you about it now. But I'm really curious, like how that works and how that interfaces with your like D&D DMing and stuff like
that? Yeah, like I think at the place that I'm taking it, in hindsight, taking one class only would have been enough, because there's kind of like these basic concepts that get covered in the classes that both of them go over. And so a lot of times the things that we might go over in one class, the next day we'll just go over it, but with D&D flavoring. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Yeah. So like this week we went over storytelling and how to tell a story, you know, doing that in real life. Like once upon a time, you know, there was a guy applying that in D&D is the same thing. You know, like once upon a time, there was an evil necromancer, and every day he looked into his crystal ball at a town down by the river, you know, and you go from there, and you can like use that as a dungeon master or something to make a little story on the spot.
Yeah, that's fun. The yes and rule from improv, that only works for comedy, right? Or that's the purpose of it, right?
As opposed to working for Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, I just mean as opposed to like other kinds of storytelling.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure, because like if it's a co-creative experience, you know, like
yeah,
and the goal is to kind of collectively jam and create something together, then like if Chris comes in and says something, I mean, we could do something now. Like Chris, say a word.
Pancakes
are.
Oh, Jim. Sorry.
Starchy.
Pancakes are starchy, right?
We did it. We made a sentence.
Yeah, we did it. But then like someone could come in and be like, oh my God, Chris, why are you late? These pancakes need to be cooked. The diner is on fire. And if that's how we're going to play, yes, ending that would benefit the bit or the story progressing. If you're like, no, I wasn't late. then that kind of like stops it, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
I have this very specific memory. I don't know why my brain chose to keep it, but we did a creative writing exercise in sixth grade where we sat, there's like three or four of us. It was like a thing you do right before winter break, I think it was. So there were like four of us in a group, and we would each write like a paragraph of like this story. And my good friend, who was like before me in the rotation, kept like wanting to take the story into like Star Wars, like all these Star Wars characters would show up. And I was like so against that. And then so like my whole paragraph would just be like, and then they all died and all the Star Wars characters went away. And then we like went back to the other thing that we were doing. And I always think about that because I'm like, man, that really like obviously he wasn't taking it the way that I wanted to take it, but because of that, it just didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, like I feel like that's such a balancing act because in class they teach that you want to play to the obvious, you know? So if the scene is we're making pancakes and the place is on fire and you're late, you'd be like, oh yes, you know, whatever you would say.
Oh yeah, I was late because I was stuck behind the fire truck.
Right, yeah. So you're like accepting the reality and building upon it. And like, it all makes sense why you're late. And so there's times to like play to the obvious and build on the current reality of the scene that's being presented. But then there's sometimes where it's fun to like subvert the expectation. And you could be like, I was late because you were being chased by the arsonist detective.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
you know what I mean? Like you can pick something that might not be obvious, but still related. But then yes, there's like that willingness of no matter what's being said, of going with it. It is kind of wild when someone just takes it in a direction where you're like,
like, all right, we can roll with that, I guess. Let's see what happens.
Jim, you asked earlier, like one of the things that have been most life-changing that I could directly say in my experience this week is there's this thing we learned called a failure bow. And it's like this whole concept of reframing how you approach failure or how having said something silly. Because if you're trying to engage in a bit, you might be thinking like, oh, that was a really silly thing to say. And so if you do say something silly, like the stakes are really low. Like in our class, we just go, ooga, like everybody thrusts their hip and says, ooga. And if you say something silly, you just make a big dramatic bow and say, I failed, and everybody claps. And like, that was such a huge life-changing moment for me to see that like your relationship to failure can be reframed so that you don't feel bad for it. Instead, you celebrate it. And so like in real life now, if I say something silly in a meeting or in this podcast, I'm not getting hung up about it. I'm celebrating it. It's a very liberating thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. That reminds me of like if you are doing poorly in Lemmings, you can just push the nuke button and all the lemmings blow up in a,
oh, really?
In a very celebratory way.
Oh, man, I haven't played Lemmings in forever, but I remember really loving it.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Is it still out, or is there like a modern version, or are you talking about a...
I'm talking about the one from like the early 90s, but...
There was a mobile version that came out like a small number of years ago that like had some of the like fun puzzle elements, but it also like kind of polluted them with weird free-to-play, like weirdly like tying the gameplay to like free-to-play stuff. So it wasn't what it could have been. But also like my only memories of Lemmings are from when I was like very small and my dad was playing it. And I just remember like in the level selector going backwards, like to level maximum instead of like level one, and just like getting completely wiped out over and over and over again.
I'm just looking at, like, it doesn't seem like it's on Steam.
Okay.
I'm looking now. I see people like talking about how they got it working on Steam Deck in an Amiga emulator.
Oh, that's cool.
Would be interesting.
Yeah, that's like good work.
My best bet is I think there was like a Super Nintendo Lemmings. Like emulating it on consoles of the era, I think might be the easiest way to do it. Like, especially if the Super Nintendo version supports the SNES mouse.
But it's not a safe place for failure unless it supports celebrating your failure by exploding all of your lemmings. Like, is that a standard feature?
Man, like how wild would it be like if they just taught in school or in life in general that like failure isn't something to get down about, you know, like,
yeah,
instead to celebrate.
When I grew up, what they taught us, and this was like what the latest psychology was that it was really important to boost the children's self-esteem, to make them believe that they are great, like no matter how great they actually are. I think we moved on to that as a culture to something a lot healthier, which is teaching kids that it's okay to be average. Like that having a normal life is still worthwhile, you know? I think that's a much healthier approach to like to living your life.
I wonder if that kind of ties into the failure thing. Cause I think I feel like being afraid to fail is supernatural and maybe like comes hand in hand with just like never wanting to mess up when possible or like being afraid of the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, part of my problem as a kid was that I identified as, and this was in part because of like I was told it over and over again that I'm the smart one, and that when I did well at something, it was because I was smart, and if I did poorly at something, it was maybe I wasn't smart about that thing and I shouldn't do it anymore. You know, like that was the implication. And I definitely was for a long time would be like if I wasn't immediately good at something, I would just not do it.
I'm still there.
Yeah.
Which all comes back to pickleball, because you can be immediately pretty okay at pickleball. I say that as a joke, but that's actually like...
Okay, that's not on the list. Go ahead.
No, it's not on the list. No, and I don't want to like hijack the topic, but I do think that part of like, I don't know, I think I have a pretty high like fear of failure and like general like caution and like not wanting to mess things up. Maybe related to that like... being like the gifted child type of, you know, advanced math class as a kid. I don't know. I don't want to say it, psychoanalyze too much. But pickleball, at least like with the skill sets that I have from like playing ping pong growing up a little bit, playing like a little bit of badminton growing up, like I had fun the first time that I played it. And I think that is what I've been told by other people is that it like is very relative to other sports, easy to start. Like you start playing and like you're already having fun. Yeah, I don't know. I still am very deep in the like, if I'm not immediately good at it, like I'm not that interested in doing it.
It's a rough place to be, but I get it. But pickleball, huh? It's immediately fun.
I mean, taking it back to okay, immediately vibing with things, taking it all the way back to improv. I had my first experience with improv like 2 weeks ago or something. One of my partner, Wacy, one of her friends did an improv birthday party, which was essentially like 20 or 25 of his friends all together in a class that was like about a 90-minute improv class. It was always something I thought that I probably wouldn't like because I always imagined improv as like something where like each person is like going up there and like performing and like it's like really intimidating and everybody's watching you. But first of all we did was play games And I love games. Like that's, yes. You know, one of my things. So I was just like, wow, I didn't realize like how much overlap there is between like improv and like games and like how much those are the same. And then also like, I was expecting like improv is like a performance that I do and like each individual person does. But what it really felt like was like, as soon as one person kind of like starts losing the thread, like somebody else would just come and pick it up. And like people were just saying things that like were not immediately obvious and were really surprising. And because of that, really, really funny. And like, It was totally comedy oriented, obviously. And it was, and some of Wasey's friends who I like kind of know, I was like, oh yeah, I kind of know them. They were just like absolutely hilarious. Like my stomach hurt from laughing so much. And I was just like, wow, like this wasn't something I expected to like. And here I am really enjoying it.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be on this podcast right now if not for the whole like reframing failure and the fear of failure kind of thing, because like it's something that I'm like, oh, I'd be worried about what I was going to say and not feeling like I'm smart enough to hang out and have intellectual conversations. Like I listened to a couple episodes way back when Chris hit me up originally to see if I'd be interested in doing this. And everybody that was on sounded so smart. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to sound like not smart. Yeah.
Here's the trick. And I try to bring this up as often as possible partly because of things like this, The editing process for this show involves cutting out all the parts where you pause to think and all the parts where you say something dumb.
That's awesome.
So everybody comes out sounding like a genius.
Yeah.
Thanks, Asper.
It's like auto-tune for podcast, right?
Yeah.
It's not auto.
It's not auto. It's
manual tuning.
Well, it's manual tuning.
Yeah. I'm paying good money for this tuning.
Nice.
Are we ready for another topic?
Barely.
Let's go.
Chris, your topic is practicing three keyboard layouts at the same time.
One thing that I really enjoy thinking about is keyboards and keyboard layouts and like alternative text input into computers. I'm not really sure why, but I really enjoy thinking about it.
Is it because you're procrastinating doing real work?
You don't have to come at me like that, Jim. Wow.
Shots fired.
You're 100% correct. That's exactly what it is.
Oh, no, I'm just projecting.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, you know how to type Dvorak.
Yeah, I sure do.
But I started thinking about it again because in the space of a week, two text entry methods that I use normally both died. One is this keyboard that I have on my phone called MessageEase, which after not updating for like 7 years, decided to start charging for its use. And I was like, okay, well, no, not going to do that. Which like, it's good, but it's not like you haven't touched this software in 7 years and now you're going to ask for money. Good. Anyway, sorry. The other thing was I had a device that I think I've talked about before called the Caracorder, which is basically just like a bunch of joysticks that you twiddle with your fingers to do letters. And the backspace joystick quit working. So that pretty much made that useless and I was out of warranty. So I went back to the drawing board of like, well, now I guess I just use a regular keyboard and get back into
like a common person.
Except get back into like alternative keyboard layouts on that. And the thing that is at least interesting to me that I noticed with that is like maybe 5 years ago, I was like, I want to learn Dvorak. And I spent a while learning the Dvorak layout. I started with like 100 words per minute on QWERTY. And then I got eventually, after using it a lot, up to like 80 words per minute on Dvorak, which I think is superior to QWERTY.
Did you consider Colomac, by the way?
So that's part of the story. Okay, that's all right. Third of the three layouts.
These sound like sci-fi names. I have no idea what this stuff is. You guys sound like you're talking in Klingon to me. Like.
Okay. I guess, yeah, for background, so the way your a normal keyboard is laid out is called QWERTY because of the first letters in the top left. Apocryphal story goes that it's a relic of like mechanical limitations of typewriters. The more I've dug into it, it doesn't seem like there's extremely good evidence for that, but they basically have your fingers flying all over the keyboard and you have to move your fingers a lot to type any words. Dvorak is the name of a person who invented a keyboard layout that requires much less motion of your hands. And then Colmac, I don't think is a name of a, I don't know. It might be a name of a person. It's just another alternative layout that also requires a lot less motion in your hands.
Colomac was designed more recently. And I would say if I learned Dvorak like 20 years ago or so, maybe a little earlier. And at that time, Colomac didn't exist. Mm-hmm. I would have picked Colomac if I was making the transition these days. But they're close enough that it's not worth making the transition again.
Unless you want to procrastinate from work.
Right. Yeah.
But what was weird is like maybe 2 years ago, I decided to learn Colmac DH, which is just like, it's like a one key swap of the original Colmac.
Why is it called DH?
I think they swapped the D and the H keys. They were like, it has something to do with like the, I don't know. It was like one of them was harder to, they just like put them in places that were ever so slightly easier to get to.
Oh, interesting.
And I think it might have something to do with keyboards that are laid out in columns. Like it's a method that works better for like regular keyboards and keyboards that are laid out in perfect columns, which I don't have yet.
Right.
Yet. A couple years ago, I decided to learn Colmac, and I think I got like okay at it. I learned it a lot faster than Dvorak somehow. I got up to like 60 words per minute, but in the process, I became completely unable to use Dvorak because like previous, like when I first learned Dvorak, I couldn't really do QWERTY anymore. But then I would just like practice, like I would do like half of the typing test in Dvorak and the other half in QWERTY. And then eventually I got it so I could swap between them.
What you need to do, you need to get to the point where your left hand is doing QWERTY and your right hand is doing Dvorak.
That's the real end goal. But yeah, so like Colmac like replaced Dvorak. So then just like a couple weeks ago, I started, or no, actually like, I don't know, whenever all this keyboard stuff happened, I was like, okay, I want to be able to do both of these, Colmac and Dvorak, so that I can like give a real honest comparison between the two and like actually figure out which one I like more.
Right.
So I have started doing the typing test, alternating all three of these. And I'm definitely like getting back up to speed with Dvorak pretty quickly because I guess some of the muscle memory stayed. But it's really weird because like Colmac like erased, like my brain just had like QWERTY mode and like not QWERTY mode. And so it like erased that. But using my...
You got no room for this additional layout.
Mm-hmm. Well, using my joystick thing didn't affect either of those because it was just different. And using the thing right. on my phone that was just like a different type of thing was also very different. So like those were like their own separate things that didn't damage any of the other skills. It's just really weird. Like it must have some like hint towards the physical reality of like how a brain learns things. This is like a very strange like physical feeling to like have one of these things just like get kicked out of my brain in favor of the other one.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the entire story.
You should switch to the, what is that thing that they use in courtrooms that like super abbreviated?
The stenographer keyboard.
Yes, yeah.
I think both the person and the machine are called Steno.
Steno, yeah.
Steno.
I have a device that's by, so the joystick keyboard is intended to also be a Steno keyboard. Basically, it's like by hitting all the letters in a word at once, it will just like rearrange the word so it was like typed in the right order, which is not exactly, Steno keyboards are like a little bit faster than that, but I like tried a little bit to learn that aspect, and it is really hard because it's not like remembering where the letters are anymore. It's just like a new motion for every single word that you want to learn.
Right. Yeah.
Like I learned the, because it's like T and E at the same time, just flick two. That one's easy. I got like the and like or. Those ones are doable.
The other thing you could do is, do you remember the new alphabet that they invented for the Palm Pilot?
What? They invented a new alphabet?
It was like a new way to write all the letters. It wasn't just like you're drawing the letters with your stylus. It was like a simplified way to enter text using a stylus.
Wow.
Similar in like spirit to the Steno, I guess.
This
it's called this graffiti.
I see like this graphic online of like these little glyphs, and this just seems like they invented a really fast way to do handwriting that everyone should do. I mean, I guess it doesn't matter anymore because we don't handwrite as much, but
yeah, no, and thank goodness.
Yeah. Okay, so like the O and the X look identical, you just start it from the opposite side, so like that doesn't work in graffiti. Unless like maybe, you know, if you have a spray can, you can like do a big on one side and a small on the other side, but not with a pencil, I don't think. Unless you draw the little dots, but that would take forever. This is really cool. I like this.
And then if you're on the Wikipedia page, you can click through to the page for shorthand, which is like even more of a mind fuck if you look at shorthand.
Is this like an established thing that multiple people can learn? I always thought shorthand was like, oh, this one person like wrote this word weird.
Well, it says here many forms of shorthand exist, so it might be
okay.
Personal.
Might be that.
But I'm pretty sure like this image here of the Lord's Prayer in Greg and a variety of 19th century systems, one of which is just called Greg. Hi, Greg.
That's probably a name.
Yep. Presumably some of these are like standardized to the point that like more than one person can read them.
Okay, the list of notable shorthand systems has like 15 entries.
Yeah.
Oh, personal shorthand, originally called brief hand. Now we get somewhere.
It really just sounds like someone was like pulled out the thesaurus just because they didn't want to. They were trying to, you know, rewrite the ChatGPT essay. Yeah. Yeah. So they replaced short with brief, mm-hmm. And hand with extremity.
Brief extremity, as seen on TV, by years for 1999.
Maybe it was just brief applause. Yeah, I mean, I think most likely shorthand is making your handwriting faster. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's much faster to just type.
What they should do is build a machine where you enter steno and then it like writes with the pen on the other side. Uh-huh. In short.
What was that? What's that movie where the squids come down?
Oh,
and they teach the language.
Splatoon. So
like Arrival.
Oh. Arrival. No, no. Arrival. Yeah. Chris, I feel like you're gonna one day form a language keyboard layout like theirs.
That was
no
so
spoilers.
Cool.
Yeah,
that was awesome. I really enjoyed that.
Good
part.
Good call. No spoilers on Arrival, but it is incredible.
Yes.
Yeah. The topic is now just like good ciphers for escape room puzzles. Keyboard layouts, shorthand, the movie Arrival, no spoilers, but you know what we're talking about. Yeah,
learn to read QR codes by sight.
Wasey got me this really cool idea. It's a QR, it's a puzzle, and the puzzle is a lottery ticket. But like the puzzle is a QR code and you have to assemble the QR code to scan it to like put your lottery ticket in. And yeah, you just like spend an enormous amount of effort doing this like puzzle that doesn't have a picture because, you know, that would just break it. And then to pull up a website that's like, you won $1. it was actually genuinely kind of cool, though. I think it's called the $1 million puzzle or the $2 million puzzle.
This is a good trick because it reduces the payouts for the gambling to the people who will bother to solve the puzzle.
I know, right? It's like,
that is. Yeah, there's no instant gratification. Scratch
I see what you did here.
Yeah. I always thought the QR codes looked kind of like top-down maps of dungeons.
Oh, yeah, they totally do.
Yeah.
Like in the new Zelda games, like the far corners of the map have these like labyrinths that you can see from above on the map. And they're very QR code like.
Yeah, huh. Never made that connection. Those are like based on the mazes in Zelda 2, right?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the history of many.
That's fair.
Zelda things.
Are QR codes? I mean, I'm not sure.
No.
Are QR codes based on the mazes in Zelda 2? Who knows?
I think QR codes were invented by Toyota to like streamline their manufacturing process. And okay. I guess thank goodness the rest of us can use them because I don't know. I think they're pretty cool. Allegedly, they work even if they're partially obstructed. But I can tell you from my experience building the puzzle that was not the case. And I had to build the whole thing.
Are we ready for another topic?
Sure.
Let's go.
My topic is I bought store brand salt. You wouldn't think this would be a big deal, but it turns out to be. So I usually get Morton's, you know, the kind in the cylinder.
Yep.
The iodized salt that you grew up with, probably.
Yep.
And I remember like trying out like the flaky salts. Mm-hmm. And I kind of shied away from them because they pinch differently. You know, you pick up a pinch of salt and it's a different amount of salt.
Yeah.
And I already had the muscle memory for this particular grain size.
Sure.
And I remember also reading that like iodized salts, they taste metallic. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to get non-iodized Morton salt and see if I can taste the difference. And of course I couldn't. Mm-hmm. But I got this. I decided I'd save a dollar. I'd pay $2 instead of $3. And I got the Signature Select salt cylinder from Safeway, and it's finer.
Really?
The grain size is smaller. It's not like pinching flour. I was going to say it's like pinching flour, but it's not. It's just it's kind of between the two.
Are you over-salting everything or under-salting everything?
I'm not even sure.
Or both. Add this to the spreadsheet, like antibiotics, iodized salt, non-iodized salt,
yeah,
Adderall, you know,
Yeah.
1, 2, 3 milligrams.
Is it Adderall like a methamphetamine salt anyway?
So yeah,
like,
it is.
I'm just tying it all together.
Luckily, yeah. They don't measure that by pinching it. They have.
Yeah.
Well,
if only they did.
Yeah. You've never been there. So I strongly disagree with your preference for Morton salt over flaky salt. Yeah. Although
I think a lot of people do. A lot of people really like the flaky salt. But here's the thing. Like, I'm going to have to relearn how to pinch anyway.
Yeah.
Why don't I just use the flaky salt that all the hipsters love?
That's what I'm thinking. I knew somebody in college who had like diamond, like the salt that's called diamond crystal, which apparently is like a big deal. And I was like, I don't know, it's salt. But then like trying to find the flaky sea salt in Safeway was just like not as good as that one. And then later I got a thing that looked identical to the flaky sea salt in Safeway, but it was really like actually coarse sea salt. And that really like messed up my salt calculations. It was like probably like twice as much salt in the same pinch for like the big mm-hmm. chunks. Like it wasn't right. like a full rock salt, but it was like halfway to rock salt, I would say. And that one like doesn't spread evenly like any of the ones you mentioned. those all spread pretty well.
Right. Yeah. It's harder to manage the bigger granules for sure. I tell you what, like when I am trying to use flaky salt, I will like take a pinch and then I'll like rub it together between my fingers to make it smaller, to make it closer to the experience of like of sprinkling the kind that I'm used to, mm-hmm. which I think is like anathema to like the whole point of the flaky salt, if I understand it right, is that it makes the food more heterogeneous texturally.
Mm-hmm.
It adds a biting experience to the surface.
Maybe they should just mix like a little bit of rock salt in the flaky salt just so every once in a while you get a real kick in the pants.
Just make one of the grains much saltier than the others. It's like getting the cherry in the fruit cocktail.
Isn't it kind of messed up that salt, like, it's like, okay, we eat all of these things and all of these things that we eat are like plant, like living things, yeah. like plants. Yeah. Animals. And oh yeah, this one rock.
There's two of them. The other one
is two?
Baking soda is just a rock. If I'm remembering right.
Baking soda is like kind of salt. I feel like it tastes like kind of salty, but like in a kind of weird way.
It's weird that like cooking is just edible chemistry. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tums is also a rock. One of the main ingredients from Tums is like a certain kind of thing.
Yeah. That's like chalk or something. Oh, it's not chalk. Or is it chalk? I don't know. They sure seem like chalk.
Cue the X-Files music. as y'all were talking, like, I can't remember the last time I pinched salt. Like, you guys are just blowing my mind. Like, we go with sea salt, just like standard sea salt in a grinder. And like,
ooh,
that's what we do.
A like, salt grinder. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like Trader Joe's has like a set of salt grinders with like different seasonings in them too. You could get it and you just twist whichever one you want.
Yeah.
I was just like, get the shaker that has like the like holes, but they're not like super small. They're like kind of bigger. They're bigger than like on a normal like small kitchen shaker, like the tube and just kind of like shh, shh, shh. Also, salt shakers are good like music shakers. They just sound so good.
That's like you guys are describing like a tactile experience that like I've forgotten about. But like the salt shaker is very the salt grinder is like a very rewarding like you know, like mm-hmm. you do like a little motion with it. As we were talking about this, I was wondering like what kind of salt would you use? Like I remember in like so like fairy tales or I don't know, like where they surround themselves with a circle of salt. Like I wonder if it matters if it's
mm-hmm. yeah,
you know,
if it's Adderall.
Like yeah, like I just that just came to mind. Like I wonder if it matters which kind you use or like yeah.
That's true. Like if like in ancient days, if someone's like, oh, I like found some salt that I'm gonna like bring home to my family for our cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Like, could that have been any of the salts available in Gatorade, or was it always just sodium chloride? I don't know. I'm kind of curious about that. I heard a really messed up thing one time. I think it was from science YouTuber Hank Green, but the fact was that like, well, all salt was sea salt.
Yeah.
That we eat at least. I was like, what?
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like there's like potassium chloride,
right.
Which is a slightly different thing. But like, if you look at all these salts in the grocery aisle, they all have the same ingredient.
Yeah. Well, except for the potassium salt, which it says don't buy this unless your doctor tells you to. That's for like if you've got some kind of like medical reason to need that, then that's when you get it.
What about the salt lamps? Is that the same thing? I mean, is this
I think so.
Salty licorice from Scandinavia is flavored with ammonium chloride.
That sounds safe.
Sure.
Isn't that like two cleaning products in
apparently, one? Like there's been enough of a problem that they tell pregnant women not to eat too much salty licorice.
Is that the same reason why like generally they tell people not to eat too much black licorice, or is that like a different thing?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I think there's something where it's like, you like black licorice, cool. Don't eat like a lot of it because it's bad for your brain or something.
Without going off on a tangent, but I can't stand black licorice. Do you guys like it?
Nope.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, one out of three.
Yeah. That's probably about the ratio out in the world too, like is my guess. Like I feel like I know more people who don't like black licorice than people who do.
I was just about to say, I remember in school learning about something called like super tasters, like people that have different palates.
Yeah.
And so like why some people prefer beer. And I remember like the professor came around and handed us these like little strips to taste. And for like the super tasters, they're like, blah, this is gross. And for like the non-super tasters, we didn't taste anything. It just tasted like nothing.
Whoa.
Wait, so were there super tasters in your group?
There was, yeah. There was just a couple of super tasters in the class that were just like, oh my gosh, this is the worst thing ever. And then I can't remember what the division, how it was set up, but it made me feel a lot comfortable about like not caring for licorice or beer or what's that thing that tastes like soap? Cilantro.
Cilantro, yeah.
So I was going to ask, is the test strip just like a stick of cilantro?
it might as well have been, yeah.
That's really interesting. I've heard of the like superhuman ability to see color. I didn't know I guess it makes sense that there's a superhuman ability to taste stuff. That's very cool.
Yeah, that was what we named super tasters after.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Like, would you rock that patch on your backpack, super taster? I guess it sounds like a band or something.
It would be misleading. It would be asking for, it would be like back when I would wear like tech joke shirts on them, like security jokes on them, you know?
Okay.
Like I would wear them because I think they were funny, but then like computer security people would try to like engage me in conversation about computer security topics. And I'm like, oh shit, actually I'm a poser right now.
Oh, but if you are a super taster and you wear a super taster shirt, like what if somebody comes up to you and they're like, hey, I'm also a super taster. These Tic Tacs, like these taste like shit to normal people, but they're like the best thing a super taster could pop. This is going to change your life.
You're here to sell me your super taster Tic Tacs?
Yeah.
I would buy them.
Or they hand you one and they like watch your reaction and you're like, oh, this sucks. And they're like, all right, you're legit.
I just throw up immediately.
Like, whoa, we got a mega taster on our hands.
Level 6 kaiju super taster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you didn't know what you were in for. You don't know what you've just invented.
There's that guy, he's like a meme, but like he's also really famous. That guy that just like gets paid a lot to taste ice cream. You know what I'm talking about?
Is that the guy who's like,
yeah, that guy.
It. I guess we'll have to retrieve. Well, I'm thinking of a specific video that we can retrieve for the show notes.
Don't they put salt in ice cream just to tie it all back so we can, right?
Oh, they must. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I always thought that was so wild that you put salt into sweet things.
Yeah.
Oh,
I will say, like, I think there's a lot of different boba like flavors that will just like add salt or like salted caramel. Salt and sweet things is very good and I love it.
And same with sour. Like,
yeah,
a lot of it. I had it was a store bought apple pie like a month ago and I was like, this needs both salt and lemon juice. And I tried adding salt and lemon juice. Like, just I'm not a great cook, but like, I know that. Like, I was able to, like, my palate is now sophisticated enough that I know that a pie, I know I can taste when a pie needs extra ingredients. Mm-hmm. And it was much better with those two things added.
You wouldn't believe how good it would have been if you had the twisty salt.
I had just added some black licorice to my apple pie.
Yeah. That sounds like something that it's like, yeah, somebody's made that work for sure. Definitely.
Oh, sure. There are evil people in this world, and they've made liquor spice.
Pranksters.
Yeah.
Do you think there's anyone who just like chisels their salt from a slab or something when they cook?
There's got to be.
It sounds like something you would do in Zelda.
I mean, okay. What? Probably there are people who don't salt their food, but instead lick the salt lick with every bite they take.
Mm, yeah, true.
Just like a cow or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try that. I'm going to just order the biggest salt.
Yeah.
Just a big, yeah.
Just like, I didn't salt these boiled potatoes, but I found the neighborhood salt lake and I'm going to see what happens.
And I brought it home with me because Neighborhood Watch isn't watching for people taking the salt lick.
The salt lick. That's right. This fleeting thought. Have y'all ever seen those photos of like giant salt mines?
I don't think I know the ones you mean.
There were some like viral photos of salt mines, and they're extremely cool because they just like dig out these enormous caverns, and they have all these like really cool like line patterns on the walls. Salt.
Oh yeah, I think I'm looking at those images now. Looks like a quake level.
Yeah, yeah.
You have taken the lead.
It really does, actually. I don't think I've seen these ones before that have very polygon shaped walls that just make it look like an old video game. But yeah, this is neat. I can't believe we dig salt out of the ground and eat it. That is fucked up.
Yeah. This is an observation that I've also had. Like every ingredient in the kitchen has some weird, gross biological origin story.
Oh, interesting.
Except for salt and whatever, either baking soda or baking powder. I can't remember.
Right.
And the same is true, by the way, for paint pigments. Like every color we interact with.
Really?
Is similar. Yeah.
They're not just like synthesized in a mad science lab.
They probably
lab.
Are now.
Oh, okay.
They got to make it boring. It's like how all food is just a chemically synthesized now. But okay, but it's got to be synthesized from something, right?
That's true. It's turtles. It's salt all the way down.
Yeah.
It's biological stuff all the way down.
Are we ready for another topic?
I think so.
For this topic, we're going to be reading this poem, "I Once Snorted an 8-Ball with Santa," by Richie Zborowski. Who would like to read this poem?
Where's the poem, Zborowski?
I'll read it. Forever ago on Christmas Eve in the middle of a blizzard, it was way past bar close, but both of us knew the bartender, so we were still in the bar, heads swirling round like snow globes. God, we were fools. God, we were young. Of course, now we're both older. Court-ordered sober. But still, all these years later, he's my best friend, wearing a shitty Santa suit bought off Amazon for $30. We'll be lucky if the seams last the night. With him out in my backyard, sloshing through the snow, making his way from tree to tree, heading toward my house with a half sack of toys, my kids perched at the window. Santa is here, they shout. He made it, they yell. When my kids look at me, I don't have to pretend. I'm just as astonished as they are.
This is really cool. Where did you find this poem?
I don't remember. I think this was one of the, if you look below, you'll see recent posts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure this was a recent post for another poem I was looking at from a previous episode.
This is cool. It's very recent. And it's very, I have so many questions about this situation, as it sounds like the author also did at the time.
My rule for what makes a poem, which I've established over the past couple of years of doing this segment on the show, is that a poem is when you do something interesting with line breaks. This poem doesn't do that. Like it's just laid out like a paragraph, but it does do something interesting with sentence lengths. I feel like that's what they have instead of the line breaks.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely feels like a poem when you read it.
Right. Because of the way I paused.
And like, yeah, the sentences are like really short, just like individual thoughts are like things happening in like little verse.
Yeah. This poem fits in the genre of one of my favorite poem genres, which is just slice of life. Here's like a thing that happened to me, and I'm going to try to paint the picture for you to also feel like it a little bit like it happened to you.
What is it about that you like? Just like the like being able to relate to it?
I think that's a lot of it. As opposed to like the poems where like it's full of pretty words and I don't know what it's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Like this is extremely unpretentious of a poem. It's like a person expressing their love for their best friend and also like talking about funny things that have happened.
Yeah.
It's so real that it almost seems like something that you would read on a bathroom stall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like as you guys were talking about like this the structure of the sentences and shortness. Like my brain couldn't help but read it ever since they had said court ordered sober. So like my brain was reading this as kind of like, I'm trying to think of what the right word would be for it. A displaced person had wrote this maybe like in a meme. It's weird how changing, like if you read something as if it was Morgan Freeman's voice, or if it was like Bill Nye the Science Guy, like who what kind of person would talk in like such short sentences? Like you had stumbled across somebody in an alleyway and then they were spitting this kind of out.
Right. Yeah.
The short sentences kind of like maybe sounds like a conversation you would have with someone who is not sober. Maybe that's part of
it. Yeah. Like I couldn't think of the right word for it. Thanks, Chris.
Right.
No, totally. Is this like a really tragic scene? Like, is the court ordered sober best friend just like really drunk? And like, what is in the bag? Is it toys or is it like bottles or something?
I don't know. Says half sack of toys. So there better be toys in there.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not sex toys.
That seems really unlikely.
I really liked your comment about it being a slice of life, because yeah, I feel like it kind of humanizes the, like if you go to the mall or something and there's the Santas there that the kids sit in their laps, or like sometimes they have those small trains that kids sit in the back of and drive around the mall. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And like those people, this seems like you're like, oh, that's so wholesome. That's a person driving a train and that's a person being Santa. But then like there's this story behind them, you know, like a little slice of their life. Mm-hmm. Which I almost got a job once as one of those.
As an engineer?
As an engineer. And like I was very tempted to do it. I was just like, yes, you know, because like sounded like such a cool thing to do. If ever I have a lull in employment, I'm totally going to go do that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you get to wear the little hat. Hopefully you get to pull on the cord that makes the horn toot.
Right? Yeah. Uh-huh. Bless the people that do that and bring joy to other people, like Santas and engineers. Like trains are freaking cool. Trains are awesome. Mm-hmm. Like it's so wild that like in your experience when you're young, and maybe you never lose this. Like I have a good friend that's still crazy about airplanes, but like there was a point in time where you're like, whoa, an airplane, or like, whoa, a train. Or like if an 18-wheeler goes by and you do a little hoot symbol and then they'll do it back and you're like, yeah, that was awesome. But like it's kind of weird how that can get lost as you get older.
Yeah. My kid is over it now, but for a while he was just the most excited anyone could be about seeing any kind of heavy machinery. Like
that's awesome.
Forklift was the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've started coming back to that recently-ish, like seeing forklifts close up operating. I'm like, damn, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There's like our apartment's like one set of windows faces the apartment complex's dumpster. And you would think that this would suck, but there is such a world around the dumpster. Like there's people that like are always staking out things that people put there, you know, like dumpster diving. So like there's this whole culture.
There's treasure in there, man.
Yeah. I think garbage trucks are pretty freaking cool. Like, you know, like they have such a singular purpose. They do a thing and it's very simple, but it's also kind of like mighty.
Uh-huh.
Garbage trucks, freaking 18-wheelers.
Yeah.
Monster trucks.
Yeah. I feel like garbage trucks are like the only thing that like the average person sees that's like a cool robot. Like a robot in the way that you think about it from the movies. Like it has a giant arm on the side and it reaches out and it grabs something and it lifts it up.
Yeah. And like all other robots, that robot arm represents the loss of like the four jobs of the people who used to hang on the sides of that garbage truck to actually...
Yeah, that's true. Oh, now it's only driver and like one guy normally.
I think it's just the driver. Like... That guy's got to listen to podcasts instead of conversing.
Yeah. Like right there, I'm pointing out of my window. There's this like kind of like high rise complex that has been being constructed over the last year. There've been some pretty neat machines going on over there. One of my favorite sights is the crane swinging porta potties around. It always makes you wonder if somebody's in there. And the other thing is the cement pump to like pump truckloads of cement up like eight stories was pretty neat.
Yeah, yeah. You pump it up 8 stories and then just watch it fall all the way back down like a fountain.
Yeah, it's just for fun. It seems like an expensive way to have fun, but yeah,
you know, they love it. They can't. They're adorable,
and the you know, everyone else does too. Everyone who can see it loves it. Pulling it back to the poem a little bit, I think one thing that I really like about this poem, or like a really good feeling that it gives me, is just this idea of like a couple of people just like hanging out and being stupid when they're young, and then like still being best friends, like, you know, when they have kids and everything. And like, I don't know, that's certainly something that I think about, like kind of heading towards the era of having kids. And like my friends are just kind of starting to have kids right about now. And like my best buddy from high school lives like an hour from here. So we've been hanging out since, I don't know, we were like 15 or whatever. And so, yeah, I really appreciate that particular sentiment.
Yeah.
I didn't do as much dumb shit as this guy, but
it's never too late.
Well, oh, yeah, that's true. And we got up to fun stuff and we'll continue to.
Are we ready for another topic?
Sure.
Yeah.
Chris, your topic is, are all creative ideas very derivative, or is it just my ideas?
Okay. This also goes back to the keyboard thing, which is how I got started on it. So like my phone keyboard that I used to use, I basically had to get rid of it because they were asking for payment for something that is not being maintained. For the longest time, I've been like, I have like a few tweaks that I would have liked to make to the design of that thing. And I've always kind of had in the back of my head, like, it'd be kind of fun to explore that. But then now it's like that thing's gone. It's like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to sit down this weekend and like finish some like really in progress stuff that I'd started to like make my own version of that thing. And I did that and I made kind of like a test. Like, it's not a real keyboard that you can actually use on your phone, but it's like a little app that it's like, if I had this keyboard, this was what it would be like to use it. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. This feels good. And then I was like, but it's pretty much exactly the same as the other one, but just like with some tweaks. And then I went into a rabbit hole thinking like, I feel like a lot of the creative work that I do is actually just like a different idea that has like one or two like changes that don't usually like change the fundamental nature. Like maybe they, like a lot of the like little side project games that I've made are like Minesweeper, but X.
Yeah.
And then, so I've been having discussions with like my partner Wasey and like with some friends about like, is that just me? Is that normal? Like, how do you two feel about?
I think the trick is that any idea that you have that is obviously worth doing, like is almost certainly an idea that is close to something that's already been done.
Is that what makes it obvious?
Yes. Yeah. That's what I mean, okay, by obvious. Whereas an idea that is worth doing that's not obvious is one that takes a lot of digging to figure out, and like a lot of trial and error to work out the kinks. Mm-hmm. And those are a lot harder to come by. So you can't, it's much harder to like come by them accidentally. You're much more likely to come by them through a lot of hard work. And even then, like, have to figure out like, okay, how do I actually make this work?
Mm-hmm.
But even just by happenstance, like any idea that you have that seems like a good idea is probably going to be one that's similar to an idea that's already a good idea, that is already known to be a good idea.
I think that makes sense. Like if you were like to think to like the works that you've made, like maybe your recent Pico 8 games, like Gordy and the Monster Moon and the sledding one that I can't remember the name of.
Bouncy's Winter Solstice Ride.
Bouncy's Winter Solstice Ride. Like, do you kind of remember how those ideas evolved?
Yeah, I do. Gordy came from like, I had just played Tunic. And okay, so my first thought was like, I want to make something like that. Like, that's a pretty derivative idea to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Like Tunic being derivative of Zelda? Or you mean like Gordy being derivative of
Gordy Tunic? Gordy being a derivative of Tunic. But yes, also Tunic is extremely derivative of Zelda.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that idea and I came up with like, I'm trying to think of the order in which it happened. I think the pumpkin thing came early. I can't remember where that idea came from. I remember doing a prototype with like robots doing wall following, and thinking like maybe there could be like Sokoban style puzzles where you'll have to like redirect the robots.
Uh-huh. So like your other game that you made for Pico Steve Mo, Maximum Overdrive 2.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, I guess so. You have to redirect the robots. But that's, mm-hmm, yeah, okay. I guess I have a few ideas and that's it. But like Gordy, I feel like everything that was interesting about Gordy came about via like deliberate choices to avoid certain status quos.
Okay.
Like I wanted to make something that was Zelda-like, but didn't just use like I didn't want to use the hookshot again, you know?
Sure.
I didn't want to use like sword and shield combat. I wanted to have something a little bit less violent. but trying to solve the same sorts of design problems that that game approached, like so that it still felt like a Zelda-like game, but that thematically felt significantly different. And so it was a lot of like just kind of thinking about different approaches to take and trying stuff and seeing what felt good. And this is, I feel like it's the case for like all the work that I've done that I feel like is really successful is just like taking an idea, maybe even a fairly derivative idea, like Frog Fractions started off as like a Missile Command clone.
What?
Yeah, that was the initial.
Oh, that totally makes sense.
That was okay. The initial part of the game was like, Rachel had sent me this art. It was like, hey, I was going to make this Missile Command clone with my brother. He went back to college instead. You want to make this with me? And I was like, sure, I'll put this art in the game. I've never made a game with art in it before. And the rest of the game was like me trying to figure out like, okay, how do I make Missile Command fun?
Okay.
Like in a new and interesting way.
You really went down a rabbit hole on that one.
My design approach is extremely methodical.
Okay.
Like I'm a very problem solver, kind of a designer, kind of an artist. And all the decisions in, I might not remember all of the origins of them, but all of the design decisions I made in Frog Fractions came about through different ways that I could solve fairly mundane design problems.
Okay.
Like using the tools available to me. Like I, like for example, I had this section of the game that was like an underwater maze. And I was like, this part of the game is pretty boring. How can I spice it up? Like, obviously, like I could add some puzzles, or I can't add art because I need artists to do that. But I ended up like asking my sister to do the background art for that section of the game. And she ended up not doing it. And later she told me it was because she felt too much pressure being held responsible for making that part of the game interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think the background art for that section like ended up being good, but it wasn't what sells you on the section as being interesting. What I eventually came around to was like, okay, what are the skill sets that I have to draw from? I have got like, I'm good at programming, I'm good at writing, and I'm good at music. And like I'd also had music in there at that point. And I ended up repurposing an essay that I had written, like thinking like I was thinking about the game Dear Esther.
Okay.
Which is a game about like exploring a beautiful environment and hearing someone recite poetry at you, basically. I was thinking like I could make it like that, but instead of poetry, they could recite this joke essay that I had written about the history of boxing.
So that came before?
I had written that several years earlier, yeah, and just put it on my blog.
That's very good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Dev, I don't know if you've played Frog Fractions. It's like pretty hard to describe, but yeah, this boxing essay is very funny. And it's you might question whether it's accurate.
I had no idea Jim you made games.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, like everything that's been mentioned, I'm like totally interested in checking out. Like Pico 8 was something I had dug into and I really loved the idea of, never got into, but like I just love the idea of Pico 8.
Yeah, I mean, Frog Fractions is the one that everybody loves. So, like, it's on Steam now. So, if you check that out, there's a couple of sequels that each take a very different approach to what to follow up on. So, maybe you could ping me and ask, like, okay, if you liked Frog Fractions, you want to check out one of the sequels, you could, like, we could have a short conversation about which sequel you should play.
Okay.
Because I think chances are excellent you won't like both. And Gordy and the Monster Moon is, I don't know, it's like a bite-sized Zelda thing. I'm very proud of it, but it's also a trifle. Like all the Frog Fractions games were like, this consumed my life for a year or more. Whereas Gordy was like, here's a couple of months of having fun doing a side project.
It is really fun. Dev, I'm curious to hear what are your thoughts on like, when you're creating things as an artist, like how does your process of ideas, like how do ideas evolve for you? But I'm also, so Dev is dungeon mastering a D&D campaign for me and some of our other coworkers, and also Dev, your partner. And that world is also like very cool and fleshed out, and there's lots of things that you definitely still can't tell me about it yet, but because we haven't gotten to them.
You have to wait until next session.
But I'm also curious like how, at least like to the non-spoiler extent, like how ideas for that kind of grew.
It's weird. Like creativity is a topic, like something I'm still as an artist or creative still trying to work because like, or to work out. And so like, I remember just on the topic of the campaign that we're currently doing at first when it was like, hey, let's do a game and I'll do the DM. I remember Pierce, one of our coworkers, was like, hey, I want to play this kind of character and I'm going to pick this certain thing. I think it was called Primal Companion. It was talking about like the rangers and their new way that they handle animals. And I think this might have been along the lines of when I was just starting to get, I feel like a large part of it is acceptance of like in creativity that like if you're picky, then it's harder to be creative. But like if you're just there and something comes through, you know, like the pipe, so to speak, and you're like, cool, I'm going to work with that. And to tie it back into improv, I feel like it's you're just yes anding whatever comes. And so I remember when Pierce presented that information at first, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be frustrating because everybody's going to pick random things. I'm going to have to figure it out. But I was like, no, what if primal's a cool word? What if we just went with that? And there's like this story about these ancient primals that were interlocked in battle and that changed the landscape. And then you just kind of like pull that thread and keep saying yes to each thing. And it's kind of like a discovery where you don't really know where you're going to go. You're along for the ride. And then afterwards, you have the background for the world or potential quest ideas. Yeah. So it's kind of like a co-creative experience with life. I know that sounds kind of wooey, but like that's how I honestly feel about it. Like, I feel like being a creative is more about getting out of the way and making yourself kind of like a conduit for whatever awesomeness, creative power exists already. And you just kind of like step aside and become like a conduit for that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting tie-in with improv because I also like I'm very, my brain is very engineer brain. So I guess when I like imagine like working on something or like working on ideas, it's a very like, I am going to figure out, like, I'm going to choose this and that and construct this. And like, I have this idea to start out with, and I'm going to do everything it takes to get to that point. But which is like very, well, at least like for my limited conception of improv, that's like the opposite of improv almost. But then I guess in like my actual experience with making games, it's like sometimes like something, like somebody just thinks of an idea. And it's like, yeah, like the idea just like comes out of it feels like it comes out of nowhere. I think that's getting at the conduit thing. It's like that, you know, who knows where it came from? And like that doesn't even feel derivative. Like sometimes my friend and I were working on this kind of like animal board game thing. And we never quite like figured out what the game was. But one day he was like, what if you're like making like sanctuaries for these animals? And once you like satisfy certain things, it like creates a sanctuary. I have no idea where that idea came from. As far as I understand, it kind of just came out of, you know, it was like a shower thought type of thing. And then that totally like, that game was never that good, but that was pretty much like the only part of that game that like made it feel kind of cohesive, which is very like not constructed. That's very much like, yes, and okay, this idea, let's roll with it. Let's like, yes, and the idea and kind of just like see where it leads and pull on the thread, like you were saying.
The word prompts, like the way I kind of navigate life is very leaf on the wind in that like sometimes words or phrases will come from somebody or in this conversation. But I remember someone, my last dungeon master, he said the word prompt or cue. And so that like, if you're in a game or something, you're constantly listening for cue, right? From the dungeon master. But then I found that you can apply that to life. In fact, like on my other monitor, I have screenshot up to remind me a thing said or done that serves as a signal to an actor or other performer to enter or begin their speech or performance. So like, anything can be a cue for creativity. So like if I noticed that like instead of trying to be creative, that if instead you have a bad day at work and you feel bad, then you can be like, maybe you can use that as the cue to base something creative off of. Like, oh, once upon a time, there was a guy that had a really bad day. And then you just go from there. So I feel like if you're approaching creativity or life that way, then like life will always give you lots of things lots of cues for creativity.
Yeah. I feel like I've got a similar kind of mindset in that I don't have creative ideas unless I don't just overflow with them like a lot of people seem to. And so I have to hold on to them when I have them or when I hear them. And so I end up taking a lot of notes, you know, like I have I keep telling people like I have a notebook, but it's actually like just emailing ideas to myself.
Okay.
But a lot of the ideas or jokes that go into my works, they started out like as just thoughts or conversations I had with friends that then immediately became emails.
Have you ever like, or do you periodically go back through the archive of those?
I will have ideas that are too old. Like right now, they're in the bucket, in the topic bucket.
Okay.
I have a topic that says, what do inanimate objects do? ?
Yeah.
And I have no idea what that means. Like this is a topic that I want, this is something that I wanted to talk about. And I can't remember what I was going to say about it or what, like, what does that question even mean?
Find out next episode.
If I ever remember, I mean, I've kept this in here for months now, thinking like someday I'm going to remember, or maybe someday I'll come up with an entirely new meaning for it that I think is good enough to talk about. We'll see.
I don't know. Or maybe Topic Lords is the place where you collectively improvise what it's supposed to mean. Yeah. You discover together what it's supposed to mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. My brain was going to like how you can assign meaning and personality to inanimate objects. And, you know, like.
Yeah. It's got to be something like that, right?
I don't know. Find out next time.
Just putting like googly eyes, like, what was it? Everything all at once. Like, oh, I remember a previous coworker, they had bought a giant bag of googly eyes and then just went around the entire workplace, putting them in random places. And so like you'd go to the like restroom and there would be googly eyes on the urinal, and it like changes the way you perceive it. And so like, I feel like in the context of inanimate objects that like.
I did a similar thing, except it was with stickers that said for rectal use only. I put them on everything in the kitchen.
I think I saw something about that.
It's almost the same.
Yeah.
And that's all the time we have for Topic Lords. Chris, if this is something that you want, where can people find you on the internet?
I don't post on Twitter at @mrchrisLHall. All
right. And good for you. Nobody should. And Dev, if this is something that you want, where can people find you on the internet?
I also do not post on Twitter. And I'm just a normal, ordinary guy that is totally behind on social media. But if you want to find me at Devin Boucher or just Devin Boucher in general, come across my portfolio or whatever, or LinkedIn.
Thanks so much for being on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. This is great.
Hi, this is Jim. This is the audio I append to every episode of Topic Lords. Congratulations to our newly anointed lords. This episode was edited by Esper Quinn, who can also edit your episode if you contact them on Twitter. If you'd like more people to hear the show, you can tell your friends about it, or rate and review us on whatever podcast service you use. You can add content to the Topic Bucket by emailing topicbucket@topiclords.com, and you can contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/topiclords. Patrons get episodes a week early, and you get access to the Topic Lords Discord, where you can discuss topics with all the lords that hang out in there. See you next episode!